So the sections we're dealing with particularly today are the listening protocols or protocoling listening, which as you could see, there was one section within the website. And I think there is a, we will get back to that in more detail. I will try to open that one before I share it, as I clearly can't change different tabs of the website while it's being shared. And that's why we started off with asking you what you're listening for. This idea of, can we write this listening down? Can it become shareable? Because that is one of the reasons it's left out of scientific discourse and theory discourses, is because how do we share that? The insecurity, the uncertainty about whether we listen to the same thing, whether we hear the same things, if we don't have a method or a structure or format, and connected to that, if we don't have vocabularies to deal with that. So this issue of protocols and the issue of vocabularies are close to the sort of core of the research that we are undertaking at the moment. We are undertaking that with different partners, which obviously I can also not show you the partner pages, but there are, on the one hand, the Southampton University, the Biomedical Acoustic Engineering there, and the audiology department there, and the people who do auscultation, i.e. Stethoscope listening. These are physiotherapists who listen to lungs with stethoscopes. And also the acoustic engineering department at the University of Southampton are one sort of cluster of partners. We also have partners at the Edinburgh University, speech scientists, and developing artificial speech for medical reasons, but also for public announcement reasons. And Mark will go deeper into that as well. We also work with the Museum of Science and Media in Bradford, which unfortunately at the moment is closed due to the virus. So there's a bit of a hold on that collaboration, but it's very interesting to think, well, what's the place of listening in the museum and in a curatorial context, which brings us also to the educational context. How do visitors cope with, because it's such a visual knowledge, in such a visual knowledge frame, and museums are extraordinarily visual. How can we bring the sonic knowledge of certain things more to the attention and the consciousness and of a public? We also work with, and Mark, if I forget anybody, do remind me, Arup, which is an acoustics company that deals with things like, for example, at the moment in England, they're trying to build a new train line up north, and it will destroy a lot of people's homes and woodlands, and it will be really noisy. And so they are brought in to do consultation exercises in, well, we play you this sound and it's this loud. Can you live with that? So what if we put a 25-meter wall at the back of your garden? Can you live with it then? And that's what it would sound like. So simulation and experimentation in relation to sort of public civic projects and the noise impact they have on people. We've also worked with Trond Mack, who is an urban designer in between Oslo and Zurich. How does sound come into urban design? How is listening important in urban design? And obviously with the artists working at Chrisup themselves, how do artists listening? And that's where we meet you in a way to kind of close this format. How can we all gain from each other's different modes of listening, and can we find a consensus? Can we find a collaborative field, and are protocols one mode of doing that, or do they bring so many hosts of other problems that it's not a very useful way to go? So that's sort of setting up the discussion for today, and I think that's probably a good point to hand it over to you, Mark, to tell us a bit about the field work we've undertaken.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Alvi. I'll just share this again. Okay. Can you all see that? Yeah. Okay, great.
I don't. Sorry. I probably haven't seen.
You don't?
No, oh. I haven't seen before from Zamlin.
Well, I think it's there.
Yeah, then it's probably an issue with my Zoom.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, maybe we press on if everyone's can see it. Yeah, so I think we thought, like, just it would be useful to spend a little bit of time and do a kind of deep dive into the field work that underpins some of this research and work that we're going to kind of move into today. So this isn't specifically about protocols as such, but it's just to try and show you how we're actually finding out how people listen in their disciplines and in their practices. We're not kind of we're not doing this as a kind of a kind of observational, you know, withdrawal of very neat facts. It's quite a layered and interpretive process. So I thought it'd be quite interesting for you to see that. And this is, like all things, this is a plan of how an ideal field cycle would go. Inevitably, this changes, but we tend to sort of start with one of our project partners going up and doing a kind of entry interview with the lead partner, which, say, Salome and I would conduct. And then I would say, oh, hello, I would stay for a couple of weeks, depending on, you know, people's workloads, and be really embedded in that partner institute and take more conversations. Also really try and participate in things that are going on. So in a lot of these disciplines, there's simulations, lab and field, indoor and outdoors, demos, things like this. So it's really trying to get involved in a very participatory way in what's going on. And then we have, at this point, we have some kind of findings or interpretations that we start to knock back and forth. And we'll go back after a period of kind of analysis, we'll go back to the partner and we'll conduct another interview and another period of conversations that will inevitably try and tie in a workshop or a public event where we can, I'll probably say this word a lot today, but stress test our findings and kind of move back and forward between, you know, things that we think we're finding with experts and then giving it into a more co-constructed environment with students and with the public as well. So we do a lot of events as part of our method of research. Again, to find out how people actually listen in their disciplines. And, you know, all of this feeds into building protocols, which we'll come on to shortly. But I like to think of this type of research as a kind of sonic ethnography of research and across disciplines. And some of you might know Clifford Geertz's terms, this thick description, this kind of idea, again, that we're not kind of standing by and observing and pulling out discrete kind of factoids and, you know, sticking them in my knapsack and running off somewhere. It's kind of very embedded. It's very thick. It's very layered and interpretive, the whole process. And there's kind of webs of meaning around everything that we do as part of this research. And I think that's something that is actually fascinating for me as someone who enjoys this side of practice. So, yeah, it's a kind of research coming from a mosaic of observations and practices and interpretations to find out how researchers listen in different disciplines. And just to kind of underpin that a little bit, I thought it'd be interesting to show some of the work we've done at Edinburgh University in the Centre for Speech Research Technology, which Salome just mentioned. I won't go into this too much because it's detailed stuff, but they conduct research and practice in speech recognition and speech synthesis. So developing kind of artificial, or we could call it robotic sort of AI type of influenced voices for medical contexts such as motor neurons disease and public spaces as well. And these four things on the side, the naturalness, prosody, cognitive load and intelligibility, these are all kind of really like key words and topics that I noticed were always in every project across everything that was going on there. And, you know, we could have a debate on naturalness all day long. And in fact, when we went back to Edinburgh to do a workshop, the workshop was based on the premise of you know, questioning what actually is a natural voice, because it's a very loaded and sort of rich thing to discuss. So when we went back to Edinburgh, we actually did a workshop on developing a socially responsible synthetic voice, which is quite an interesting experiment with those researchers. Prosody is to do with the grain or the kind of melody, pitch and tone of the voice. Cognitive load is a very interesting thing around listening effort, which I'll play a sample actually from a researcher soon to talk about that. And everything is guided in Edinburgh by this idea of creating artificial voices that can be heard and understood. So there are intelligible things that guide that. So I'll play you two very short examples, because it's always nice to hear sound with sound-based kind of work, isn't it? So these are just two interviews. The first one is Avashna Govender, who is a researcher who investigates this cognitive load issue, which is the effort of listening. And Avashna sort of tries to test how effortful it can be to listen to a non-human voice. And she's always trying to reduce this effort. So I'll just play a tiny little clip of this.
When you listen to human speech, it's automatic. It's an automatic process. It's quite easy because we are used to listening to human speech. Whereas when we're listening to, the hypothesis is that when we're listening to computer-generated speech, then we believe that because it's got a lot of artifacts or it's not perfectly modeled, this could interfere with the processes in our brain, and therefore the amount of load that we're putting on our brain to listen is much greater. So this is what I'm trying to understand.
And then I'll just play another example from Carol Chimez, who I can get on here. Yeah. She's a researcher, again, based at Edinburgh, her work sort of investigates the simulation of real life environments in order to test synthesized speech against. So often, I'll come on to this, during a listening test, you judge synthetic speech on backgrounds of white noise. Obviously this isn't a very real scenario. You know, cafes, streets, all this thing are what we actually listen through and with. So Carol's work investigates this. But here she's talking about intelligibility more broadly, which is again this huge theme that runs through all the work here. This thing won't let me sort of press play when I jumped it. Stay. I might just have to jump in, maybe.
True human.
It's funny, it won't let me get to that. I'll skip this one for now. but yeah, so some of the kind of things that we're looking at and listening for is around, you know, what researchers are listening for. That question we asked for you, which is really difficult. Question, how researchers listen, inevitably it goes towards methods, and I think that's where a lot of today's work will end up with protocols. You kind of end up really diving into your methods. Again, whether researchers in Edinburgh have formal protocols, some of them were very tacit, some of them were very on paper, ready to go. And again, this thing that Salome mentioned before, we're really interested in, I suppose it's issues of trust, really, like the how you trust your ear as against the visual spectrogram. You know, what one do you place your trust in? And on the back of that, the vocabulary that is being used. So this is a kind of very participatory moment, the listening test. And it was great. I spent, you know, a couple of weeks in Edinburgh and was kind of locked in these chambers doing listening tests. They're very grueling. They can last between 30 to 40 minutes. You basically get put in a kind of tall sealed cupboard on your own with headphones. And there's a kind of an A-B rating kind of system often. So you'll go in and you'll be listening to a synthetically designed voice. And there will be a kind of questionnaire that says, is A better than B? And so on and so forth. Or it might be a rating system of grades 1 to 5, and better being whatever the test is judging. So if it's judging naturalness, it's very open and broad, and it's, is A more natural than B? So it's these kind of setups. And there's you know, obviously there's very big contradictions to how listening works in real life here in this simulated environment. And I'll play this example from Simon King, who is the lead professor here. I need to move my little screen because it's over stuff. Here we go.
We put people in soundproof booths with really high quality headphones on and make them listen to not necessarily the most normal sentences ever and get them to rate them on 5-point scales. This is not ecologically valid. This is not a task you would normally do in everyday life, but that's how we do it. And so we're trying to get from that to some sort of simulation of real life. How realistic is your test environment? You don't actually always want it to be the real world because it's not so reproducible, right? If you really went in the street and got people listening on their phones, then the street would be different every time. You get a different result every time. So you need some sort of reproducible or controllable simulation. And so the other end of the extreme is we'll just put people in complete quiet conditions with headphones on, because that's absolutely repeatable. It's the same every time. And we can show that, you know, across a big enough population of people, we get the same result. You know, get these 30 students in and rank the systems. Well, the next batch of 30 will rank them the same way. It's very repeatable, but not very valid.
Detailed formal agreements embodying these arrangements should be worked out between the Secret Service and both of these agencies. Detailed formal agreements embodying these arrangements should be worked out between the Secret Service and both of these agencies.
I'll talk about why that was composed in a minute, because we're doing a series of podcasts. So as part of this, let me just move my screen. It's kind of funny. And you can see these kind of chambers here that I talked about. It's very interesting for us when, you know, considering what a listening test is and thinking about how, you know, we as artists would usually listen in the environments that we listen in, whether it's outdoors or indoors. It was very striking how, you know, these tests were always indoors. They were always through headphones, always judged against white noise usually. And something that was very interesting was there was no collectivity to it at all. You know, I think there's seven rows of these sort of chambers, and people can be simultaneously doing a listening test, but you're isolated, you're locked away. There's no discussion. There's nothing like that. So, you know, that was kind of intriguing for us. And I'll come on to that in a second, but just to sort of say that we're, there's all this kind of rich data that we sort of research and come through fieldwork. And again, this idea of thickening it, like I think we're making a podcast series at the moment, which kind of layers and entangles the voices of researchers with the spaces in which listening takes place. Again, so this is not a kind of voice from nowhere sort of narrated radio show. It's going to be a very layered and embroiled thing. And I just wanted to play a tiny example of this from one of our partners, Trond Mag in Oslo, who is an urbanist and a kind of expert in sound and urban acoustics. And it's just a very quick clip about his work, which, you know, we went to Oslo, we interviewed him, but then I did a day's sound walking with him as well, because he uses sound walking as his primary method to investigate the city. So it's just a very short example of how some of this material is being kind of thickened into a podcast series. And let's see if this works.
Det är liksom den samma vinkling som där uppe, så allt som kommer in där här blir förstärkt av den gaten här. Så hvis man
maybe sound walk is the wrong word actually, because I also know that meanwhile we have regulations, sort of regulations, what a sound walk should be or could be. I think it's just a guided walk on. With a specific focus on sound and architecture, or sound and city development.
And then just before we kind of shift into protocols, the other way that this kind of research is thickened again is through workshops, like I mentioned earlier, and it's something that Salome and I have been collaborating on with the Points of Listening project for a long time now, and it's something that we can do through this project. And so this, can you see my cursor sort of doing things? Picture in the top left was a workshop that we did in Edinburgh, which was around this protocoling idea of how does one protocol a socially responsible synthetic voice, which is very challenging and an interesting thing. And this image here connects back to, if I can get there. The image in the top right-hand corner is a kind of alternative listening test that we ended up doing back in the sound arts department at UAL. So Carol from Edinburgh came back to London, and instead of doing a listening test on headphones, we had it in a kind of speaker array. Instead of doing it in isolated booths, we had it open in a room with tables and groups of people. instead of kind of judging on scales of 1 to 5 or A and B, there was a much more collaborative, consensual emphasis in the groups to kind of say, well, what did we think we heard? And then there was a lot of room for discussion and debate as well. So it's really nice to bring research back and to push it through some of the filters that we maybe accept as our norms as sound artists. So that's a kind of, somehow, just a kind of grounding or a kind of introduction to how we actually do this research, how we research across disciplines, and how we try and find out, you know, what people might be listening for, how they're listening, what tools and techniques they're using, and what essentially what protocols and what vocabularies might be wrapped around that as well. So hopefully that's useful, but and maybe we can have a moment for discussion as well now, but we can also shift into the protocols as well. So I'll stop sharing for now, shall I, do we think?
Yeah, maybe we could take, because I know it's quite a lot to you know, to take in and of a very different project. I mean, if anybody wanted to ask anything, bring it back to anything, that'd be very happy to answer some questions at this point about the project.
I just was wondering, because of course you've shown this small prison cells for listening tests, the computer completely damped, which is a little bit not necessary if you wear wet headphones, yeah? And then you've shown this room, this space. But anyway, as far as I've seen, there were loudspeakers. So it's a different way to listen, understand it via loudspeakers or with somebody talking in the space itself, isn't it? I mean, I remember I had to pass, it's 30 years ago, TOEFL, the test of English as a foreign language. And they have a listening and understanding test, which is quite the same. So it's a loudspeaker presenting a text. But it's something else if I speak in a space, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very much, yeah. And I think that's the thing that I think us with that artistic humanity, sensibility, we noticed that immediately, and we thought, well, this seems interesting, and it seems like very ripe as well for testing back in a sound arts kind of discipline. And it felt really, you know, you're kind of always thinking about how your discipline can maybe impact another or vice versa, and it felt really important actually at that moment with the scientists and all their kind of you know, sort of hierarchy in terms of knowledge and all these things. It felt like we had quite a lot to offer there actually as artists, and we could really start to expand how they listen. And Carol, who came to London to do the workshop, she's written about that process, and it's feeding back into her research, which is quite nice actually.
I really don't mean it as an artist or so, I really meant it from the way we perceive. I mean, if you could see it, they had a round rigging, then they had a lot of speakers, which means you have a sound field which are everybody hears the same. But this is completely unnatural, because if somebody talks from the side, from the front, you will have a direction. And if you put out the direction information of the listening information, of the speech information, I think it's quite important. You just know that you have now in the cinemas this 7.1 and so on, but voice is usually coming mono from the mid of the screen, because if you really put it from another source or another direction, or even if you have a home in cinema and you put the sound from the speakers, which is only on the right side, you are detached from the speaker. Even they think it's much better sound, but the direction is very important for the connection with the speaker and the action, the understanding. I think so.
I think what is one of the very interesting things about the research is this, in all the partners that we have and have worked with and have field work with, what we could observe was there is this discrepancy of, on the one hand, yes, working with sound, but trying to put it into very visual and very controllable measures of assessment, like natural, what effort does it cause, intelligibility. And so it is controlled to be scientifically valid and valuable. It has to be controlled within a visual scheme, and that is very, very interesting. And I think that's also where, as artists and musicians or whatever work with Ubisound, with our sonic sensibility, we can come to science and say, well, Yes, this will get you to something that you can measure and write about and be certain about. And you will then create, I mean, in this case, a lot of speech synthesis people would design the speakers you hear every day on the underground, in a bus, in wherever, these announcements that have the sort of idea, oh, they have to be intelligible, they have to have a natural voice, they have to be provide effortless listening. And it's very interesting when we started in our workshops with them that followed the fieldwork to try and open them up to issues of ethics, issues of, well, whose voice is effortlessly heard? You know, what speech is natural? Particularly in an English context, that is a very important question. Is it the Queen's, level of speaking, her sort of accent, her... how she speaks, what is considered natural, and that natural isn't just a given. It is a cultural construct. And as artists, we work with this all the time, and we try to disrupt this social construct and all the race and gender and economic values that are embedded in that intelligibility. And it was a very interesting meeting up in Edinburgh to try and bring people to think about the falseness or the construction of the naturalness and the construction of the effort. But we also worked with audiologists who work together with the army, and they have to decide whether somebody can go back into war, can go back into battle, whether their hearing is good enough to go back. And the apps they had to develop to make it more real in that sense, Peter, that you're talking about, where they're trying to, yes, we could just have a lot of white noise and we give you a command to shoot this or that person. Can you hear it well enough to shoot the right person? But that's kind of doesn't really make sense in the combat environment. So they're designing apps that can actually fake the combat noise, which is obviously very different to sitting in a cafe and being given military instructions, or being in a tank and it's noisy and you've got headphones on and you've got this and you've got that on. So that was very interesting. On the one hand, the need for control and measurability of the listening as an effort and as a naturalness, and on the other hand, an acknowledgement that when in the real world scenario of a war, we really need to be sure they can hear, we give them the right command. So we have to bring this more artistic, more vague and material into this listening process. And that struggle science seems to have is to us very interesting, but also, yes, in a thick research as we're trying to do, very, very exciting to see these contradictions around protocols, around approaches.
I was just going to say as well, the comment that Simon King, who's the lead at Edinburgh, that I played, you know, he says, they're very aware of this, but they kind of, it's as if it's just bustling back and forward all the time, this idea of, you know, it's to do with scientific measurability and certainty on the one hand, but then he admits it's definitely not ecologically valid, i.e. it's not a kind of real world application that accepts difference and all these other things. So it's a really interesting tension to work in. Does anyone else want to say anything? Salome, I think your mic's turned off.
Yeah, just also encouraging people to, if they have any questions before we move on, but you don't have to, it's just to kind of...
So I just had a quick question. It was something I noticed, that some people have the ability to zone out noise or to be very selective with their hearing. So how do you create a method that fits all? Because it's not just about hearing, it's also about focus and concentration. So how do they manage that problem? For example, like a mother has a great ability to not hear their children playing. Like, you know, if they're making a lot of noise, you can literally zone out of that and listen to something else. So in a war zone environment, if you think of a combat, somebody should be able to have the ability to focus out that noise and focus on something else. But that won't be equal with every person. That's a very personal ability. So how can one thing fit all? No.
I don't think it does, and I don't. And I think there is an acknowledgement that it doesn't. But within the scientific desire for outcomes, I think what we as artists quite happily would explore as hearing diversity or deaf gain has to be suppressed to a degree. Although the audiology tests, they were obviously individual. They were very, very individually designed to really make sure the soldiers they sent back into battle could hear, at least according to their design. But you're right, in speech synthesis, that is different, wouldn't you say, Mark?
Yeah, I think it is. But I was just thinking about how they zone out like that when you said about method, and it made me think very like, okay, what do they actually do? And I think the spectrogram might be a method for zoning out, perhaps, in terms of in Edinburgh, they'll know exactly what they're listening for. They'll, you know, it's quite a, what's the word, tautological kind of process. Like they kind of know what they're listening for and trying to prove. And often the spectrogram is a place where they can point and identify and confirm and legitimate what they already kind of were looking for or listening for. But within that, so there's a kind of real zoning process there. It's a really focused thing. But it was really interesting for having conversations where you sort of ask a question, well, what are you not seeing in that, or what are you not listening for? Because there's a huge amount of information there that's just disregarded because they're not listening for it. And that, I think that as an artist is something I love, coming along and sort of sweeping up and, you know, and gathering all that stuff that's left in the margins from someone else's listening. But I think the spectrogram is maybe a place where they zone out. I don't think you can have a one-size-fits-all, personally. Yeah.
If I want to allow to say something, Lisa, you're saying if you can focus probably to somebody speaking in a restaurant, yeah? Mm-hmm. And you're just able to cancel or to block out the other noises. Yeah. Very interesting. If you do a recording of this and you play back the recording, you won't be able to focus.
Yeah.
With a technical playback.
Yes.
Yeah, as far as I know. So I think it's probably not only spectrogram, because the recording is just not possible.
Yeah. And that's something interesting that Carol's doing, one of the researchers there. She's doing these real world recordings and putting them back into the simulation unit. And I tried one and it was so different to hearing white noise as a background. I couldn't function almost. I couldn't hear any speech. That was real, you know. So that was super interesting.
And I think it is that sort of the real life, which is the contingency of listening, that is so demanding, or that where we're not entering a space and then we hear the space, but we hear ourselves in that space, you know, whether we're a mother or we're not in a noisy playground, will be a very different listening, to take on Lisa's example. And I think that is what science cannot maybe get at. But every time we've worked with a partner, I think we could inspire some thoughts around that, at least, and some sense of, because obviously science has its restrictions, its funders, it needs to get to results within its scientific thinking. And so it's driven by that, and it has those results. But of course, as artists, we sort of come in from the side and say, yeah, but what about that? And what about this? And I think together, not against science, but together with science, we can actually maybe reach the whole spectrum of what sound has to offer for knowledge. We can use those things Mark wants to sweep up after certain points have been identified, as well as the valuable points that have been identified, and bring them into discussion with each other, different listenings. And I think that is why it is exciting. It is not just about bringing listening to science in a new way, but actually establishing a new relationship between art and science that is not this interdisciplinary relationship where practice-based research illustrates a scientific process. And we've sort of talked about that last time a little bit, where art's job is just to sort of demonstrate and make it palatable, make it understandable for the public, but where it can actually literally intervene and make suggestions and broaden what is possible. And we felt, maybe Mark, if we want, maybe this is a good moment to move on, and I share the next screen. We felt one way of having this interaction, and you should now see another page of the website because I changed the website in order to make this possible. One way, or well, there were two ways really in which we feel such an interaction between artistic listening, sound arts, musical listening, and this scientific, very driven and sort of pure listening towards something they already knew had to be there. So a listening for something in the specific rather than a listening for whatever is out there could meet was in this notion of protocols, in a critical idea of protocols, because in sciences, you have very much a sort of a protocol that establishes your listening, the way you listen, as something that is like a menu that you can pass on to somebody else. An acoustic engineer can say, this is how I listen, here you go. This is the way we're doing this together. And it can be repeated, repeatability being such a really important element of scientific listening. And so we wanted to look at these protocols and whether artists, whether we have protocols, whether they are useful things. What are they in art? What are they? What do they represent? Are they scores? Are they descriptions? Are they graphic scores? Are they text scores? Are they whatever they are? And so this is the page that so far stands for the protocols. On this side, the image you see is a kind of a workshop with people in Edinburgh, so speech synthesis researchers, doctorals and postdoctoral students, that we put through our ideas of protocols and see what happens if we bring our take onto their very scientific design structures idea of what a protocol is. And what we've come across, and I think what comes up in the discussion, is the idiosyncrasies and the paradox of a protocol for artists. The idea that you write down what you're doing when what you want to do or where you're working on is a kind of a disruption of that which is pinned downable, a disruption of a process that precedes what you want to hear. And still the need and the idea of, are there protocols in artistic listening? Are they used for artists? Are they interesting and established? And so here we're trying to set up a little bit that, yes, we want to work with protocols, but we want to work it in that, within that conundrum and within that problem of what it offers and what it takes away. That it offers a way that I could go out and listen and write it down and give it to you, and you could go out and seemingly maybe do the same, but everything that it would shut down, everything that it would reduce the listening process to. And so how can we work with protocols in a useful way while giving space for that friction and for that idiosyncrasy to do its work? And that's sort of where we are in part at from our first batch of partner visits. And Mark, you will tell us a little bit more about protocols. So I'm going to unshare.
This is like a nice sort of dance that's going on, isn't it? I like it. Okay, let me try and share. Share PowerPoint. Okay. Yeah, so we thought it would be kind of interesting, I suppose, to just run through some of the protocols that we've found within this research, within different disciplines. And that process has been, not straightforward. You know, protocols, like we say, they're often tacit, they're often kind of come out of a conversation. Maybe a kind of structured interview doesn't even reveal a protocol either. It's kind of, it can come out through a side conversation or through an action that you notice in a lab or a demo, and you think, okay, there's something in there. So these things are always very difficult to get to, and it's not kind of pointable knowledge immediately. I think that's what's very exciting about it, actually, and hopefully we can work on this together and find it exciting as well. But I thought the first one, so I've got, I think, five of these lined up. They're just short excerpts, like 2 minutes each. The first one is from Carla Meyer, who is based in Copenhagen at the Sound Studies Lab. She's a postdoc and her work investigates sound, art, and post-colonial histories in relation to public space and sculpture, which is like a huge thing right now, especially with everything that's going on. So in this clip that I'll play, she's sort of talking to Salome and I, and I guess like finding her feet with what her protocol might be. She's just sort of speaking these kind of ideas and these things out during a conversation. And then after that, I'll show you what that kind of conversation actually became as a formal document that she provided to us. I'll see if I can play this. Yeah, it's 2 minutes.
I've written something down already, but I tried to, because I also had, so I'm thinking of how I wanted to prepare the listeners to go on this walk, mm-hmm. right? Okay. So you start in the here and now, like in the present. And like feel your own body and how your feet are touching the ground. And like your eyes can stay open but not look at something in particular. Attend to your breathing. And then start to listen to the sounds around you. What are the sounds that seem very close to your ear? What are the sounds that are in the background, in the distance? What kind of movements? What kind of movements are there? How do the sounds play together? Like how they how do they overlap? And it's like can you listen to it as a kind of like composition? And then go back to your own body and just listen to what just catches your attention, and then combine it with movement and start moving. And then just have yourself be guided by the sounds you hear and like what your body does in relation to these sounds. Oh, it's something to that totally different. I think that's it.
So this text that you can see is how that conversation ended up being kind of formalized by Carla into a listening protocol, and very much, you know, a kind of emphasis on questions, I think, which was really interesting to see. You know, we can talk about this and just feel free to chip in as well if you want to respond or talk about anything right now, but I was interested in how she had a lot of questions in this protocol, and doing research into protocols and the traditional idea of a kind of dogmatic set of principles doesn't really allow for questions, whereas a sort of sound practitioner had questions across the whole protocol. It's a very inviting, invitational idea of a listening protocol that I suppose documents her process of listening at the same time as opening up the opportunity for us to do it. I don't know if anyone has any comments or thoughts on that, but
I just have a question, which is probably, I'm not sure if I really understand the word protocol.
Mm.
Protocol for me is doing a at least after done something, or we have a protocol of a meeting or so on. So I seem to be in something different. Here it seems to be to have something like a manual, what to do.
I think that's partly maybe a German-English language translation issue. So yes, no, a protocol is something that you would set up of a how to do. So it's not what you get after a meeting, which in our case, what would you call that in English? What you get after a meeting, like you get the meeting notes?
No, I don't think it is a
yeah. But so it is I need to do this, I'm setting out to do, I'm going to do it in this way. And as artists, we probably often don't have them. So for Carla, who is an anthropologist, musicologist, but in a very practice-based way, it was always she had to sort of think what that might be. And you're right then, Peter, of course, for her, it was an after an event, because I sort of really felt when she was talking in her speculation and hesitation, it was a rethinking of, well, how did I do that last time? For me to do it now. But as we move on to sort of the more science professions, you will see that they very much start with the protocol. But I think this confusion between is it a before or after is actually very interesting, because it makes it iterative. Like, where does the before start?
Yeah, and to be honest, these are the questions, because we thought maybe we'll play some of these and then we can open this for this type of discussion, but maybe we just discuss this anyway throughout, because I still think the question is really valid, like throughout the whole of these two sessions, what actually is a protocol? You know, it's a really strange thing, and I think we should keep that really open at the moment. It's a really good open question to have, and we can all, I think, maybe contribute what we think a protocol is, never mind what ours might be, but we maybe start with that layer and move on.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, yeah.
So does this, I understand what a protocol is, does this then, how she's describing it and reflecting back and thinking of the how she does it, does this then, as a protocol, sort of like how Peter was saying, how you do it, does this then become an instruction for someone else of how to do it, or is it just her protocol of how she thinks and how she does, listens? Like, could I take this and go, okay, I'm going to listen like she listens, and that's her protocol. Let me see if I can take that on.
Well, that gets us to the point of, whereas in the sciences, there is an assumption that a protocol is completely shareable, because there is no subjectivity. There is no problem of me doing your protocol or you doing your protocol. The framework means that an objectivity can be established where I just follow, if I follow your instructions, I will get to the exact same outcome that you would. And as artists, we're sort of much more critical and speculative of that and of the contingency, particularly of sound and of the contingency of subjectivity itself, the small moments of how we hold the microphone different or how we breathe differently during something like that. As an anthropologist and somebody who does sound walks, that's what Carla does as part of her practice, are sort of sound walks in terms of, in relation to historical anthropological issues and contemporary sculpture. That is very interesting. And I think that's where the gaps in her protocol and the thinking comes from. It's almost like, well, is this now for me or is it for you? And will you be able to do it? But I think that is where we're working on, well, if we want listening at the table of knowledge in a legitimate and with authority, are protocols a way? Can we deal with protocols? Can protocols get us to some sense of a shareable knowledge of sound? But your question is completely spot on. Yes, what is it? Is it now an instruction? And if I do it, will I get to the same place? And that's interesting.
Yeah. And that's where the project's going, really, in terms of, you know, the idea is to swap protocols with the different disciplines. So what would happen if a speech synthesis did the urban planning protocol, let's say? You know, it's quite an exciting potential there. I just thought, maybe because I can't, I've got the screen sharing going on, if we want to respond to Peter's question of like, what is a protocol, it might be nice to just apply that to the chat box. So if everyone thinks, as we talk through this, about what a protocol actually is, it could be a nice way to log any thoughts or processes in that chat box. So Holger Schulze, who I think, Salma, you talked about Holger last week or the week before as well, didn't you? So you're probably familiar with some of his work, the professor and director of the Sound Studies Lab in Copenhagen. And Holger wrote his protocol for us based on six listening steps that frame his research practice. And this kind of clip that I'm going to play, it frames the aim of his protocol, which for him is to understand the steps he takes to get to what he calls an idiosyncratic method of listening. Again, this was a conversation, very fluid, you know, real conversation between Salome, Holger, and myself. He went away, reflected on those thoughts and provocations. So I'll play this clip of him speaking, and then I'll pop his protocol up again.
The variety of bodies, of experiences, of biographies, of sensibilities in listening is so wide that it simply doesn't make the nearest sense to close them that quickly to some normative structure of listening. Having said that, I come to this, in this book, in the main part, Anthropology of Sound, to a model that focuses on the individual, personal, also idiosyncratic listening routines, habits, desires, fears, obsessions. Because I think indeed that how we listen, and that means how we precisely listen, not in general, in a vague acoustic statistic normalization, but in the details, in the incredibly minuscule details. It's so idiosyncratic and so particular that it's now more interesting to go into these idiosyncratic details that then still will provide a lot of commonalities and shared experiences. But maybe shared experiences that are not trivial, that are not abstract and not normative, but encourage also to carve out the stranger bits of listening, which I find really interesting and I find really intriguing. And every one of us has inclinations and aspects where he or she doesn't want to listen to or feels overwhelmed or annoyed or bored or whatever. And I think to carve them out, that's important.
Okay, and this is again how he formalized in a very, actually it is quite a kind of step-by-step, six-point plan process of how he gets to this idiosyncratic method of listening. So yeah, it's time kind of ebbs back and forward, I think, when developing these types of things, because you are necessarily reflecting on your process of listening, you're kind of reflecting on how you document it, and you're also thinking about how the heck you might translate that to someone else. So I think this process of back and forth, how these things actually develop, that's started to really fascinate Salome and I. And it shifts this idea of a protocol that is, you know, ossified and locked into something much more generative and open and operatable. I'll jump straight into this next one because I'm aware of time. Oh, can you all hear me okay? I should come closer actually, shouldn't I? I'll play another one from an audio engineer in Southampton, Folk Martin Hoffman. He's a research fellow in engineering and physical sciences, and his work's primarily concerned with audio engineering and acoustic design for kind of loudspeakers, also home listening and contexts involving cochlear implant. And I'll play this again. It's a conversation we had, and then I'll pop the protocol up. It's quite a fun one, this, actually. He calls it his modus operandi for doing listening measurements.
One thing is always ideally measure at night.
Really?
Yes. Reason is simple. There's no other people around. There's no one flushing the toilet. There's probably less lorry traffic. There's generally less traffic. And the problem with sound is very often we have a lot of structure-borne interference. So if someone... Great example. Let's say someone a bit on the sturdy kind, and it actually gets severe if someone is wearing high heels, just because of the coupling of that little tiny... pin of the heel. If they walk even two floors up, if the concrete delivers those frequencies well, they will transfer even into our anechoic chamber. Mm. And these are actually artifacts that, depending on the measurement technique that we deploy, pose massive problems and will affect the quality of the measurements.
Is that kind of sheet that you did, like an informal protocol?
It's informal, but we use it group internally.
Could we have a look at that at some point? I'm quite fascinated.
Maybe we can send
it, or we can...
Yeah, sure. That shouldn't be a problem. I don't think there's anything confidential on that. One other things is, like, so of course, always know your measurement system. So we use some sort of like a sound card or data acquisition and playback system, and that should be known. No artifact in that system should ever affect your measurement, because you know it, and therefore you can completely take it out of your measurement, as in you don't have to worry about it. What other aspects? If I remember correctly, it's like always, it's a bit profane really, but it's like always be very well prepared in terms of the equipment that you need. It has a bit of a sort of group sociological aspect about it, which is to like make sure that all your equipment is available and so that you do not interfere with other researchers, but like, in terms of the actual, but that plays into all of the actual measurements. And of course, have an idea of what you expect.
So a little bit like the kind of science context of speech synthesis, the audio engineering context was very much, kind of knowing what they were listening for or measuring. This came up in a kind of very fragmentary way during the conversation. The engineer's like sub knowledge that he didn't really declare as legitimate, but it was like this kind of informal list that was his checklist really for doing this type of work. And we found this quite interesting, and it felt like an informal protocol that, you know, is definitely legitimate and worthy of kind of looking at and listening with. We've got a couple more. I realize time is going, but I think we're okay. So Anna Barney, who is the co-investigator on the Listening Across Disciplines 2 project, she is a biomedical acoustic engineer at Southampton University. And here Anna speaks about a very kind of what seems quite mundane, really, in terms of how she auditions lung sounds, either in her office or her home, and the type of equipment she uses. And she doesn't really talk about protocols, it's more about habits. So that's another thing to think about, maybe the habits and rituals that we use.
Can you control the volume of the playback?
Yes.
Because it's very loud, and I think Zoom then puts it down, and then when you start to speak, you are very soft.
Okay.
It takes 12 seconds, I just measured it.
Oh, wow. Amazing. That's great. But do you think I should put the sound down on the file?
A little bit down, yeah. I think that's fine. Thank you.
There's habits. When I've got to listen to things, I nearly always do it in my office rather than at home, if it's work listening. And I've got a not terribly up-to-date desktop there with a pair of really rotten headphones. They're another sort of about £15 and you buy them to do Skype. And for some reason, I ought to have a pair of really nice headphones. I listen to things, so I ought to have a pair of really nice headphones. And I haven't. I've got this rotten pair of Skype with the bit of foam's come off one ear. But I wouldn't say it was valuable, but it is habit that's what I've got and that's what I use to listen. And sometimes I don't really want the really high fidelity reproduction because I want to hear what it would be like if you were hearing it in a clinic, or could you use this if you were doing it in a sound. Hospitals are really noisy places. The background noise, we tried to build a wheeze detector, and what it turned out to detect was ambulances and mobile phones mostly. And even when you listen to somebody's chest, you can hear that through, yeah.
What I love about this is in the conversation with Anna,
And there's probably about a year lag between that conversation and her formalizing this in her protocol, when she kind of circumnavigated a protocol for her own listening and talked about rituals and different practical things. But then when it came to actually putting it down on paper, she really like listed it. As you can see, it's very rigorous and step-by-step process for auditioning sounds that have been gathered by a stethoscope, lung sounds that have been gathered by a stethoscope. And I think there's an interesting point in here. Point five, I think, is interesting. Like, it's almost a bit like a map, the protocol, in a way, in this sense. She says, if there is no signal, go to six. If there's no signal, discard the file, go to the next track, start back at one. So there's a kind of like reorientation constantly within her protocol that becomes a kind of mapping process as well, and quite playful, I think, potentially. I'll keep going. We've got two more, I promise.
I think it's fine.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so we have Debbie Thackeray, who's another project partner based in Southampton, like Anna. And she's a doctor in physiotherapy, specializing in auscultation, which you may know of, but, you know, this kind of listening to the body via a stethoscope. And Debbie listens to the lungs a lot, which is obviously, a very poignant issue right now with the pandemic and respiratory disease. And she also teaches this to students. And Salman and I have been lucky enough to go into sort of simulated environments with Debbie, where she is taking students through a kind of patient analysis process, all the way from getting a phone call saying, we have this patient coming into hospital, to an actual simulated mannequin that lies in a hospital bed, and gets students to use stethoscopes that has the body, the mannequin has pre-programmed lung sounds in the chest, so that they're trying to simulate a real life patient, because lung sounds have specific sounds and specific sound signatures. And particularly when you're listening for lung disease, there's things like Velcro crackle, they call it, and a wheeze sound that can happen in different points of the lung. So they kind of know what they're listening for there in terms of damage and disease and these things. So again, trying to get to how Debbie thinks about that process was really interesting. And we discussed a sheet of paper, which I'll pop up quite quickly, but this is Debbie talking about a possible idea of a protocol for her within teaching.
The document we've got in front of us is a marking sheet. So this was a visual way for me to ensure the examiners were recording what they saw the student doing. So I don't know if I'm answering your question. This is for us. This diagram here is used in exam situations to check the student is performing it the way we want to. In our teaching, yes, the students are also given those sites as being the protocol, the gold standard of this is where you place a stethoscope.
Yeah.
So they get it first in their teaching, and then we use the same diagram, protocol, whatever you want to call it, to check that they're doing what we've taught them.
Yeah.
I'm looking for the consistency, because when we run OSCE exams, we could be examining up to 12 to 13 students as an individual throughout the whole day.
Mm.
So you have to have a mechanism to be making sure, one, that the students are being consistent in the task, and secondly, that the examiners are marking consistently. Mm. So yes, the visual, I think the visual, that diagram is part of it, but it's not the whole part of it.
Yeah.
And I'll move on to the final one, which is from art, sound arts, yay. Angus Carlyle, who is based at CRISAP, professor. And Angus's practice is, as you can see from this lovely picture of him, you know, inevitably takes him outdoors, recording environments, and his work, I guess, connects to issues of ecology and conflict and memory as a sort of a mesh of these things that consistently come up in his work. And this is a clip of Angus talking about listening in his practice.
Yeah, I guess one of the things I really like about my listening strategies are that they are never disconnected from other sensory modes. That's one thing. Another thing is that I think that those listenings are ones that find themselves in the field after, not always, but frequently after a prior operation of attunement that's based on kind of research, I guess. So one of the things that's interesting for me about that listening is how can you be guided in your listening through, it could be book-based research, or it could be talking to people who spend more time in the area that you're investigating than I do. But it's a way of, I think I have a facility to be guided by other people's listenings towards a listening, but all whatever deficiencies are involved might be one that I can take something different from. But I think it's a kind of, I think in part I have a residual skepticism towards expertise, and that skepticism would attach itself to a listening expertise if that listening expertise was understood to be primarily one of hearing a broader frequency spectrum, being able to discern, and in the sense of source, recognize elements within that spectrum. So that kind of listening is an incredibly admirable quality, but it's not necessarily one that I see as guiding what I would want to do as a listener.
I don't know, let me come out of this actually. Stop share. Because we can either have kind of open that for discussion, or we could have a short break and come back to it. I don't know what you think, Salome and Peter.